This is an introduction to English, or you could call it British literature. And I'm Thelma English. I'm happy to be here. And I see a lot of familiar faces. Some of you I saw here last year, some of you just the last hour. We are going to take a survey through English or British literature. And I think first I will read the little paragraph. English literature. Was Beowulf a missionary tract? Did Shakespeare establish a vocabulary that would help theatergoers to read the latest Bible translation? In this session, participants will be introduced to the finest English works and understand the reasons why our students need to read them. That's a good introduction. That's exactly what I hope to accomplish here in the next hour. An hour is not a lot of time, and so I've given you a very extensive handout. Some of you have already heard me say, I am the queen of handouts. This handout represents many years of study, and it just gets revised every time I use it and take it somewhere else and I add to it. One handout is going to walk us through English or British worldviews that are reflected in literature. The other handout is a little timetable so that you can see representative works and books where they fit in with a little bit of historical information so that you can kind of see, hopefully, the big picture. I have a few resources to recommend, things that I think are essential for studying English literature. If you're going to be studying English literature at all, this would be your main purchase. This is the Oxford Companion to English Literature. There is the Oxford Companion to Classical Literature, the Oxford Companion to Shakespearean Literature, the Oxford Companion to American Literature, the Oxford Companion to English Literature. And this is the one. You can look up any English author. It's alphabetical. Any English author or major character in a book, major movement. You could look up Renaissance or Realism or Naturalism or Deism or Cook or Dr. Thorne, a novel. You can look up all of these authors and works in this book. So this is your encyclopedia. And the only thing is that these are very expensive. I think they're like $50 books. I don't have the price. Usually I keep track of my prices. I don't have the price I paid for this one. But that's a standard thing, and you're going to use it for the rest of your life. So check used. It doesn't matter if it's used. It's probably better if it's used because it'll have fewer modern, postmodern things in it. You know, so used, old is better. If you're looking to begin introducing Christian literature to your kids, this is McGill's Masterpieces of Christian Literature in Summary Form. This is an incredible book. I got this used for $25. I hate to recommend things that are out of print. This is out of print, so you're going to have to go online and search for it. I got mine for $25, and I keep loaning this to my friends at seminary. This is my fourth year as a seminary student. Yeah, I got it used in 98 for $25. But this has summaries, four or five pages that summarize all the major Christian works. So if somebody says, oh, well, you haven't read The Penzies, you know, by Pascal, and you think, I don't even know who that man is or what that is, you can look it up in here and read three or four pages and then at least have a working knowledge of what that was, what it meant, what place it had in the big picture. This is another great, I'm not going to call it a cheater book, this is like a giant Cliff's Note. Wow. And so this is from, this I got from Barnes & Noble. In fact, it's published by Barnes & Noble. This is The Book of Great Books, A Guide to 100 World Classics by John Campbell. And I think this was really cheap, too. This was inexpensive. I think this was, oh, I didn't write it down. Usually I keep track. I believe this was under $15 because Barnes & Noble prints it themselves. And so this, all the famous books, including most of Shakespeare's plays, it will even tell you. It gives you a critical overview. This is representative of naturalism or realism or something like that. It's going to tell you all about the main characters and exactly what happens in a book. Because if you're like me, you haven't read all these books, and now you're going to teach them to your kids, and you haven't even read them yet. And so you're going to know the story. Read the story in here, and then you'll be ready to know, no, I don't want to read that book, or yes, I want to read that book, and you'll know what the major themes are. We'll go through the Christian worldview, and hopefully you'll be able to measure that through in there. Invitation to the Classics. This is a great one. This goes on sale all the time through Great Christian Books for $15.95. Earlier this year, I have to make sure there's nobody here I know. I bought 7 of these. I have 43 homeschool students in my 3 different classes. I teach literature. And this year we're doing classical studies. And I have 5 teacher assistants. And so I bought, 5. So I bought 5 of these earlier this year. I got them for $15.95. I'm going to give them as end of the year little thank you gifts to my TAs. So if you know anybody in my classes, don't tell them that. This is a prize. But this is great. And it's got pictures and everything. So this is like my kind of book. Another book you're going to need is a handbook to literature. And it doesn't matter who published it. You don't have to have this particular one. All this is alphabetically going through. You can look up catastrophe, catharsis, Celtic revival, Commonwealth literature, expressive criticism, exposition, industrial revolution, anything that has to do with literature, a mask, what is Sisera, what is a Sisera, that type of thing, parable, all of the Arun, what's Arun, all of those things, and then it's got a timeline of literature in the back. And this, I think, I picked up used for about $10, maybe $12. This one's the Harper Handbook to Literature, and the only reason I bought this one was because it had Northrop Frye's name on the top as one of the editors, and he's a Christian literary critic, and I recognized his name, and so I bought this one. But this is good because otherwise, how do you know what those literary terms are? So this is just literary terms, and anyone will do. In fact, if you don't want to buy the book, if you have access to the internet, you can just look up literary terms or something, or handbook to literature, and you can find something online that has all of these terms. Reading Between the Lines, many of you have heard of Jean Edward Vaith. This is a great guy. This is where I get my one line that I really like. I tell my kids in Lit Circle that if you see something or read something and it offends you as a Christian, it is probably because it either trivializes or profanes something that you hold to be sacred. And I really liked the way he expressed that. And that was from this book. And this is another one, The Discerning Reader. And I got this one because it was Leland Ryken. And I know at seminary we read his biblical criticism. And so I recognized the name and thought, and this is really good too, because he goes through and talks about the Bible and literary study, Paradise Lost. He's got all types of interesting chapters in here. So this is like literary criticism stuff. But if you only, if you bought one book, you'd probably want to get the Oxford Companion and then the Book of Great Books, 100 World Classics. Those are just valuable to have on your shelf. You have one handout that has all of the literary philosophies connected up, and then a timetable of English and American history and literature. On your timetable, the one that's in 2 columns, everywhere you see an E means that is specifically English. I also have things on that timeline that are American, and I don't think I marked those with anything, with A's or anything like that. I did. Some of those are marked with an A. Because I wanted you to be able to intermesh American history, American literature with English literature and history. And so most of the major works I've marked with the E. And then you also have tons of footnotes. That I'm the queen of footnotes. And you have permission to photocopy anything I give you. Photocopy it for anybody you want. I have no problem with that. And I now have, I told you last year, my son was going to put up a website for me. He just graduated last year with a computer science degree, and I have my website now. It's at the bottom of all your handouts, www.thelmaslibrary.com. And isn't that a neat name? So I've got that name for at least 5 years, as long as I don't forget to renew it. And so now we no longer have to worry about email addresses changing and that type of thing. And so there are all types of resources there. I forgot to mention in the last class, one of the newest resources, if you've heard me speak before, you've heard me talk about the 4 things when you study a book. You can have your students do a character study. You can have them do a theme study. You can have them do a plot study. Or you can have them do an author biography where they research the author. And so, for example, if you wanted to have a little literary circle of your own and you don't want to write study guides and do the kind of stuff that I do, you could say, we're going to read this book this month, and this month you're going to do a theme study. Next month we're going to read a different book, and you're going to do a character study. Choose a character. The month after that, you're going to do a plot study. And the month after that, you're going to do an author biography where you research the author. And do a different thing each month. If you have a small group, you could let the kids pick what they'll do. Just never do the same thing twice, and then let them present them in class to each other so that you learn from one another. Well, how do you write those papers? How to write a plot, study, and analysis? All that's now at my website. So I think it's under resources. So go to Thelma's Library and then go, I think it's under resources, and all that you have to do is download those, and you've got those. And I have grading guidelines for those so that you as a mom, you know, did they identify this? Did they identify this? If they identify these 10 things, this is worth 10 points, so that hopefully you can kind of sort of subjectively grade a paper. We know how hard that is. You know, it looks good to us. It's an A. So that's all available at the website, and you're more than welcome to copy those, you know, give them away, whatever you want to do. That's all there. For many, many years now, I've been reading books, studying worldviews, and writing curriculum to teach the concepts of Christian worldview literary criticism. We don't want to just read a bunch of good books. We don't want to just dissect characters. We can look at all of history, philosophy, everything of the world like a big quilt. I'm sorry if you were here the other hour. You'll just get it cemented in your mind. If we look at all of history and literature as this giant quilt, each book fits in somewhere into this big picture. Everything before Christ, pointing to the birth of Christ. All of history, all of literature, everything prepping the world and reflecting the world being prepped for the birth of Christ. Everything after Jesus Christ, prepping us for his return. We can see that the world is getting more and more ungodly. As we turn our back away, we can see the preparation for the return. And so when we study these books, we don't want to just say it's a good book. We want to know, what is this reflecting in the society that it was written and the way the characters act and change through the book? What is this showing us about the way the world was then, and what was right about it and what was wrong about it, and what can we learn from it? That's Christian literary interpretation. We don't want to just have literary criticism where we dissect the character. That's what I did in school. We just dissected the characters and we did all of these things that we were never going to be able to use again. We want to do things that the kids can use again, things that will get them excited. These studies have led me to the doorways of some very important secular and religious thinkers who've participated in what Mortimer Adler calls the Great Conversation. And that is where one author connects to the next, influencing the next. That is the Great Conversation. And of course, the idea, what we want to do, the Christian presupposition is that this conversation paints a picture of man in all of his God-reflected glory or in all of his shame. And we as the reader have to look at that and judge for ourselves. Each literary movement represents the greatest thinkers of its time, whether Christian or secular. The job of the Christian literature teacher is to expose the underlying supposition of those great thinkers and hold them up to the light of biblical truth and expose the truth or the untruth. The practice of this type of literary criticism provides the young reader with important literary interpretive skills that they will be able to use for the rest of their lives, everything that they read. And more importantly, it will open to them the possibility of participating in the Great Conversation. I would guess that represented in this room, there are some of your students. I know we aren't all so smart, but I know my kids certainly are. And I would guess that some of the children that are represented here are incredible writers and readers. I know because I have an incredible 43 students in my class. I am amazed by the students that are in my classes. I'm just amazed. And some of these kids may very well be participating in what Mortimer Adler called the Great Conversation. They can influence people and change lives. Old English. We're going to divide English literature as Old English, Middle English, and Modern. Old English, we need some type of a representation. With the fall of Rome, okay, AD 476, the fall of Rome, we enter the so-called Dark Ages. That settles over the entire world. We call it the Dark Ages, or we call it the Middle Ages. It actually was a very light time for Christians, and so Dark Ages is kind of an inappropriate term, but know that that's what it's called. With the firm unifying hand of the Romans gone, okay, they held it all together. They built the roads. They Alexander, 300 B.C., loved everything Greek, spread Hellenism, so that when Jesus was born 323 years later, everybody in the known world spoke Greek. Everybody could trade in Greek. Everybody could travel around the Mediterranean. The trade routes were all established. The roads were built. Romans invented cement that they still can't duplicate today. We can't make cement without rebar that will stand for 2,000 years. Okay? What did that just happen? We see everything preparatory for the birth of Christ. Okay, Jesus is born. Now we have the fall of Rome, 500 years later. The world moves away from all the cities. We go into, that's why they call it the Dark Ages. The world moves away from the cities into the countryside where the monks and the missionaries find incredibly fertile ground for the gospel. The world is ripe for the gospel. Men like St. Augustine transport us through the ancient barriers. Augustine was dying as Rome was under siege. Augustine's Confessions. When Christianity was on the defense, to the threshold of medieval times, when the Great Commission was revered, that was a big deal in medieval times. Why did Christopher Columbus, when the explorers went out, the Great Commission? Monks, with a veneration of anything ancient, pagan or Christian, preserved everything, Hebrew, Christian, and classical, at a great cost to themselves. Everything could have been lost. You know that Paul's first and second letters to the Corinthians are really his second and third letter to the Corinthians. He mentions his first letter in my previous letter. Everything could have been lost. Paul wrote most of everything he wrote under the nose of Nero. Everything could have been lost. Look at the prison letters. That means they were written while he was in prison. And he wrote them. And they went all over the world under the nose of the emperors. And all of these things could have been lost to us. And these monks, sometimes at a very high cost, preserved these things so that we would have them. Preserved them, hid them, and copied them faithfully by hand, letter by letter, so that we would have them. When we look at the Old English worldview, very strong belief in fate. I meant to add slash weird. It's spelled W-Y-R-D. W-Y-R-D. It says worldview, strong belief in fate slash weird. W-Y-R-D. That's where our word weird comes from. It's the Old English word for fate. And that was part of their worldview, that just happened. Very much there was this synchronism, like when the Israelites were in the Promised Land and they blended everything together. Now you're going to see Christianity blending with the paganism. The Christians go out and the pagans start picking up little Christian themes here and there, but they're still pretty pagan. It's going to take a while to change the world, isn't it? They don't throw away these idols and get rid of their lifestyle and their heroes immediately. So we have a synchronism of church and pagan worlds. We have an admiration of heroic warriors who prevail in battle. This is an Anglo-Saxon, this is a big deal, warriors who do really well in battle. This is part of their culture. Mm-hmm. And now the Christian monks and missionaries are coming in. And so they need to teach these people about Jesus Christ. And so what would you do if you were a monk or a missionary and you need to teach these pagan people who really admire warrior-type kings? Hey, give them a Christian warrior king. Give them a story. My good friend, Dr. Haluska, who helps me out extensively, he teaches literature at Southern Adventist University in Tennessee and has worked with me with my Beowulf studies. And this is the way he teaches Beowulf. And there are actually a lot more Christian literature teachers teaching Beowulf in the same way now. That Beowulf could very, very much be, it's probably a Northumbrian poet. You've got a little map there somewhere so you can see where Northumbria was. I told you I'm the queen of clip art. It probably isn't legal for me to photocopy that little thing. I shrunk it, and who knows what book it came from 15 years ago. Beowulf is a 3,183-line heroic epic written by an anonymous, probably a Northumbrian poet, and it's the single extant manuscript of its kind. That's why everybody reads Beowulf. There's nothing else like it. There's nothing else Old English that survives from that period to demonstrate what Old English was. This is the lost heroic age. This is their age of heroes, warrior kings. There's an emphasis in the Saxon tradition You, for example, if you read Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, and you've got the Saxon kings, you've picked up that the Saxons, what were they? Emphasis definitely on loyalty, courage, revenge, very Germanic, very much Germanic. The theme is clearly fate or weird. From archaeological finds, we know that paganism existed alongside Christianity during the era in which Beowulf was composed. We know this because we find crosses and we find pagan things at the sites, for example, Sutton Woo. There are revealing Christian elements in the poem and certain conventional modes of utterance and traditional forms that tell us that the author was a trained poet. Pope Gregory had instructed his missionaries in England to work through the pagan beliefs rather than wipe them out at a stroke. Okay, this is what the current pope at the time said. He said, work through what they have. You know, when we send missionaries to a place, do we try to make them American? No, we learn their language, we learn their culture. Very often Wycliffe translators will even publish, I know I have a friend who's a translator, and he will publish healthcare books before they'll even print up the Gospel of John, the first book, because that's what the people are interested in. They want to know about health care and cleanliness, and so they'll learn to read. If they can't even read their own language, they'll learn to read to be able to read that. And then when John comes out, when they publish that first book of the Bible, they can read that. And so this is, you know, this is a good technique. So this is what Pope Gregory told them to do. The Beowulf author reveals advanced capabilities and learning. He's very obviously a very educated person, and there's a fusion of pagan and Christian thought, I think on purpose, leading some to believe that this man came from a monastery. The time is roughly between 650 and 750 A.D. in what would become England. Northumbria has just undergone her own renaissance, during which the Catholic and the Roman and Celtic churches went head-to-head over which would take over a previously pagan country, and Rome won. Now they're sending missionaries to the still pagan kingdom of Mercia. You can read incredible stories about the kingdom of Mercia. You know, the king, some other Christian king, married off his daughter to a king, and so she's married to this pagan guy, and he ends up converting, and they go into the temples and they throw down all the idols. Incredible stories of what's happening with missionaries during this time. The problem is, how do you make Christianity palatable and attractive to these people who value revenge and warrior kings? You know, what do you do? Along with that, how do you assure them their own culture isn't going to be just blown away by this new religion? Well, you might take an old story from the time when their ancestors were still living in North Germany, Denmark, and slide in some Christian stuff. Poof, there's your missionary tract. For most teachers, the Christian aspect, such as the warriors singing hymns to Christ in their drinking hall, if you haven't read Beowulf, it's time. You can read it in one night. It's a tactless intrusion. To me, it's an essential part of the story, linking the first English epic with the Northumbrian Renaissance and the formation of England itself with Christian missions. Bede, the first historian and a Northumbrian, wrote his vision of England united under Christ. Look for Christian symbolism in the fight with Grendel, the fight with Grendel's mother, and the slaying of the dragon in the end. He goes underwater for 3 days. He has 12 companions. One abandons him. Very many Christian allusions. Lots of Christian. Do you have a question?
Are there different versions of Beowulf?
It's translation. Believe me, if you saw the Old English, you couldn't read it. It looks worse than Hebrew. The cheapest one. You can get a Dover one for a dollar. Yeah, you can get one from Dover for a dollar. The Rebsamen, I think, is the one a lot of people buy, and I think you can even get that really cheap. But I have no problem with the Dover one, because you're going to lose the... it has a caesura, like four beats, pause, four beats. It was done like to a drum, and you lose all that in translation anyway. So read it in translation and then read about it to know that's what it was. The cliff notes for this book are great, and you'll get little maps, and you'll get the family tree of all the kings and things like that. The great heroic age of Beowulf fell to the simple gospel of grace. The missionaries go in, and Christianity prevails. Self-sacrificing men and women who gave their lives. Tons of missionaries went down into this area. And it's just incredible. The Norman conquest of 1066 brought about the changes that would turn Northumbria into European civilization as we know about it today. This is the Norman conquest, 1066. That should just be one of those dates you have in your brain. 1066, that's the Norman conquest, William the Conqueror. This changes everything. This changes everything. The Venerable Bede wrote the Ecclesiastical History of England. Beginning in the late 7th century, Bede produced the first great coordinated history of the European Middle Ages. And it's called the Ecclesiastical History of the English People. And it's actually fascinating reading. Bede's friend Eadfrith, the Bishop of Lindisfarne, have you heard of the Lindisfarne Gospel, the beautifully illustrated one? You can go online and see pictures of it, the Lindisfarne Gospel. Produced one of the most beautiful illuminated manuscripts of any period anywhere in the world. Those are the Lindisfarne Gospels. During the same period, a magnificent stone cross, now preserved at a church in Scotland, and originally standing some 18 feet tall, was produced by a master artist who, along the margins on two faces of the cross, made runic inscriptions that are from that are one of the examples of one of the finest Old English poems that we have. And it's, the poem is called The Dream of the Rood. You should read this. You can go online and type in The Dream of the Rood, R-O-O-D, and you can read it in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, and it's one of the most beautiful poems you'll ever read. I think they come in and turn it over. Thank you very much, though. Yeah, I appreciate that. The Dream of the Rood, in which the cross of the crucifixion speaks, and it tells its story. It's just the most... And, of course, you can see why schools are not going to grab this one. They're not going to use it. And it's beautiful. So you read Beowulf, and you read this poem, Dream of the Rood. Okay? And you've got your classical pagan stuff, and you've got your Christian stuff. Then we get into our Middle English period. This is, notice the date there, 1066. Okay, this is that's the Norman conquest. After the Norman conquest, we come into the Middle English period, and this is 1066, the Middle Ages or the Medieval Ages, depending on what you want to call it. The worldview, the church is going to instruct the illiterate masses. Okay, people are illiterate, they can't read. That's one thing, you know, it's not like the Roman days. When you had schools and you had the, you know, Pax Romana, the Roman peace, you may have had soldiers everywhere, but you did have peace. And that's all gone now. And so what we have are people scattered all over the place and thus illiterate. The chivalric code of honor, this appears. This is where we venerate women, you know, above all else. These are your knights in shining armor. And William the Conqueror, you know, if you go in and you conquer a place and the people hate you, the Normans go in and they conquer the Saxons, and the Saxons hate their guts. And the Normans, what are you going to do if, you know, you put all your people in key places? Well, the first thing you're going to do is build some fortresses, and that's where all our castles came from. You build all these castles to protect you from the common people who live in the land who hate your guts. And then eventually, you don't have a lot of contact with them right away, but eventually the languages begin to blend, and we see the Anglo-Saxon, which was very guttural Germanic, impossible to pronounce, sounds like Hebrew or German or something, it flowing into something nice. The Anglo-Saxons would say, we eat beef, and the Normans would say, we dine, you know, we dine on beef. We eat meat or we dine on beef. But the Normans, you have that French influence, and so it's a much smoother, nicer sounding language. And so there's a huge shift in the language, and it's going to take place slowly over a period of time, but these two cultures are going to blend. The Saxons who are living in the land and the Norman conquerors. We're going to see a blending of this. The oral tradition continues where you tell your stories and they tell their stories because people can't read and there's no printing press. Folk ballads to remember the stories, remember the wars, what happened. Now, how are we going to teach people Bible stories if they don't have Bibles and they couldn't read even if they had them? We're going to do plays. So we have these mystery plays. These portray Bible stories, the mystery plays. And miracle plays are saints' stories. And so you can look up on the net mystery plays or miracle plays, and you can find, you know, what's still in existence. The one that we read is Every Man. Every Man. And it's wonderful morals in these little plays. And you've got to have your kids read one of these. And you can get little Dover editions for $1 of Every Man. They've got a lesson. Culture and religion, the church is instructing its people through these plays. The illiterate population is entertained. They're able to learn through seeing these plays. Then we have the Crusades. You know, after 622, that's Muhammad. And after 622, the entire world changes, and everything's going Muslim, and the Muslims are going over the entire known world. There are some incredible battles that are lost and some that are won, and the Crusades are trying to win back some of these lands. Traveling increases dramatically as a result of the Crusades. The Crusaders bring back things no one has ever seen before. Okay, they go off to all these foreign lands, and they bring back spices and fabrics and clothing and things that because the East was much more developed than we were, weren't they, during the Dark Ages, or than Europe was. And so they bring back things, and people want those things, and so they start establishing trade, and we become a global type of economy and trade. Every man, I think that's in your handout, right? It says every man. In the ancient and medieval world, the miraculous, the persistent, recurrent intervention of God or gods and goddesses was almost universally accepted as indisputable. It's a little different today, isn't it? People didn't question whether miracles happened, and so they had them in the play. Saint Francis of Assisi was busy narrowing the culture gap between the conquered and the conquerors. Okay? He was friends with the Normans and with the Saxons, encouraging an end to the feudal system. Soon, Marco Polo was exploring the Far East. His written account, when published, would inspire Christian men like Christopher Columbus to seek out new worlds in an effort to fulfill the Great Commission, the Age of Discovery. Puts a little different slant on some of our history studies, doesn't it? The Doomsday Book. William the Conqueror. What do you do if you go in and conquer a land? Can you make this written inventory of what you've got, what lands you have? Is just an incredible, just good for the students to know that exists, this account. The Mort d'Arthur, these are all the Arthurian legends. These are worth reading. Their kids will read those with a flashlight at night if you'll let them. They're so exciting. Do them as read aloud. The Canterbury Tales. Read the general prologue. Read the Knight's Tale. It's a chivalric romance. The setting is medieval, but it's set in ancient Athens. That didn't bother Chaucer. You know, it's set about 600 BC as the setting, and yet they're jousting and doing all of these medieval things. But the king is Theseus from, 500 or 600 BC. It's really funny when you look at Chaucer. That didn't bother him at all. He was very creative. So, but some of Chaucer can be very coarse, very coarse. So you don't buy the Dover editions, because I did. I bought 40 of them, and then we couldn't use them, because I didn't know what was in them. So don't buy the Dover editions of Chaucer. You're going to have to buy something else. Read the general prologue. Read the Knight's Tale. Read the Pardoner's Tale and the Prioress's Tale. And that's enough. You could read the Nun's Priest Tale. Oh, and you can read the Parson's Tale. I have more of a list. And the Parson's Tale, okay. Which is a sermon with an obvious moral. It's an allegory, Reformation ideas, which actually were profound in his time. The Parson's Tale actually reflects the Reformation ideal of Scripture alone. Sola Scriptura. Chaucer could have been hung for that. It's fascinating what he has, and then he has some vulgar things in there. It's an incredible mix. You can download these from the net. I download them from the net, and then I put them on photocopy on sheets, but I make them in two columns. When you photocopy things for your kids to read from the net, don't have them read all across the page. It's too hard on your eyes. Put it in two columns when you do that type thing on the net, because it's easier on the eyes. Let's see. The one you do not want to read is called a Fablio, which is going to have lots of coarse humor in it that you will not appreciate. It's going to offend you. Is the Miller's Tale. You are coming up with a language and words that they both understand. And so we can have a fusion of the conquered and the conquerors now. We create a new vernacular. This is a new common language, preparing the New English Society for a commonality and eventually preparing them for the Word of God in English. This is a very important. But do you see why we can't just read the Canterbury Tales and say, this is good stuff, you're supposed to read this. Let's dissect the characters. What use is that going to be to you in your life? We need to have a reason to read this book. It needs to somehow honor God, glorify God, or help us in our whatever God calls us to do. It needs to be part of that. We don't study fluff. We shouldn't be wasting our students' time at home studying things they're never going to use again. And so this is very purposeful. This is very purposeful. If you were the outnumbered conquerors, oh, this is about the castles, and I jumped ahead, I guess. Chaucer's lifetime was 1340 to 1400, on the very threshold of the Renaissance. Okay, he's on the doorstep of the Renaissance, and on the threshold beyond that, just beyond that. When we talk about 1500 and beyond, we're in modern history. The last 500 years are modern history. And Chaucer is 1340 to 1400. Chaucer embodies all three worlds. He's a microcosm of the age. That's where he stands in history. The medieval system of values with the hierarchy is very much expressed there. Have you heard of the hierarchy conception? This is a medieval worldview where you'll see it in books, especially now that you know, look it up, or there's a book called The Great Chain of Being. You have God at the top, and then you have Jesus or Mary, depends on if you're Catholic or not, and the Pope, the angels, the bishops. Everybody has their place in the Great Chain of Being. Okay, everybody in the hierarchy conception. Everybody has their place. And you get down to men, and then women are right under the men. Children are right under the women. Animals are right under children. Plants are right under animals. And then the earth is at the bottom. What do we have today? Do we practice a hierarchy conception? What happens if you turn that absolutely upside down? That's called revolution of the hierarchy conception. Chaucer demonstrated Renaissance ideas with some savage wit. He demonstrated Reformation ideas that would have been absolutely shocking for 1387, especially the Sola Scriptura. Absolutely shocking for his age. We come into the Renaissance. You have all of the worldview there. I'm going to guess you know a little bit more about the Renaissance, and so I'm going to go into some, and you have the information here. Worldview, you realize that the Renaissance is a shift from religious, eternal things to humanism. That was the Renaissance, rebirth. Okay, you're going to go back to classical things. Let's develop the human potential instead of what God made you to be, what I want to be. The concept of courtly love we see in all the Renaissance literature. The woman is so beautiful. She's really too beautiful and too good and too lovely to even have. We'll just kind of worship her from afar. A courtly love. However, love can die or change. You no longer have love that is forever. You can love someone and then not love them. Okay, we have the first introduction of that kind of concept. You know, that's not foreign to us today, but it was new then. And so we see drama, poetry, sonnets, plays, culture and religion. Authors for the Renaissance, William Shakespeare. You know, pick up a book that has, I think Barnes & Noble has them, and I know that Cliff's Notes has them, outlines of all the Shakespeare plays, so that when you study things, you can read the right plays to go along with your historical time period, so that if you're reading classical stuff and you're reading, like, for example, the Aeneid about Aeneas coming home from the Trojan War, you know Troilus and Cresside, Shakespeare's play, that Aeneas is in there. So if you just read the outlines of all 36 plays, you'll kind of be familiar with the stories, and then you can mark them. Oh, this would fit in when I teach this. This would fit in when I teach that, and you can read them. Neoclassical, the Restoration, and the Interregnum. I'm not sure if it's Interregnum or Interregnum. Does anyone here know the pronunciation of that, the correct? Interregnum? I have a real hard problem with pronunciation sometimes. This is the time period, No, it's the interregnum or interregnum. This is the one period, interregnum, this is the one period in English history, 1649 to 1660, I believe, when there was no king. That it's this interval period. And many things happened during this time. Many people didn't. This was just after the pilgrims left. Remember, they wanted to purify. The pilgrims are gone now. John Milton is writing. He writes Paradise Lost, which is the fall of man. However, Paradise Lost, it's also a political piece because we've just taken back a king in England, and he's saying, we have just lost paradise. We gave it up. We had our opportunity not to have a king, and you wanted a king. Paradise Lost. Very much has political undertones. Paradise Lost. We see in the during this time, and of course the Restoration then is restoration of the kingdom. 1660 is restoration of a new king. That's what this period is. And we're really at a disadvantage because very few of us are ever taught any English history. It's worth going to a bookstore and getting a kid's English history book with all the pictures and everything so that it's something you can read in just a day or two and get the big overall picture without thinking, now I have to read English history and I have 10 other subjects to teach. It's worth getting just a kid picture book on English history so that you kind of see where all of those people fall into place. Definitely we have an emphasis on reason and logic, stressing harmony, wisdom. John Locke is in here. His essay concerning human understanding had an incredibly tremendous influence on all future writers. You can go to the net, get the text of that, download it, read it. It's not very long. We see the use of satire with irony. So you have authors like you've got authors like Defoe writing Robinson Crusoe, and you've got Jonathan Swift writing Gulliver's Travels, which has extreme social reconstruction type undertones, what he wants to do. Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, this is an essay, look that up and read it. He says, well, I know how we can solve all of the poverty and the hunger in poor Europe. He says, we'll just cook up those poor kids and we'll eat them, and that'll solve both problems. You see this definite use of satire and irony during this time, and so many of these books reflect this. John Milton wrote Paradise Lost. He tells us in the very preface, in the beginning of the book, he tells us it's to justify the ways of God to man. I have the Norton Critical Edition. I wouldn't buy any other copy. If you're going to read Paradise Lost, read the Norton Critical Edition. He was fluent in 6 or 8 languages, something like that, and so his English is not real straightforward. He mixes, his grammatical construction is not always easy. And he's 40 years post-Shakespeare. If your kids could read Shakespeare, they can read Milton. I believe that Milton is just a little more difficult than Shakespeare because of the construction. He calls Eve, my favorite line in that entire book, he calls Eve God's last best gift. And I love that. You know, sometimes you read something and you remember it forever. And I love that. But that's what he calls Eve, God's last best gift. Alexander Pope's going to write Essay on Man. You need to write that. You can download it and read it. It's only a few pages. To justify the ways of man to God. Okay, this is in response to Milton. Milton wrote to justify the ways of God to man, and he told us that in the preface of his book. And Alexander writes in his Essay on Man to justify the ways of man to God. This is the way the world is going. Do you see what's happening? This ends the classical period. That's it. Alexander Pope's essay. The classical period's over. That's the last thing. Now we're into Romanticism. And definitely, if you were here the previous hour, I'm really sorry that you have to hear it again. However, it's worth hearing again. This is generally, in my literary circles, this is one of my most popular lectures, and a lot of times the parents come to these, or they ask for tapes, and they want to listen to these to try to get Romanticism down. I don't know if I mentioned, I probably will be teaching at Kurtz School this fall, English and American Literature, if anybody is still interested after you hear me talk all this for an hour. Romanticism is biblical principles rotated, turned absolutely upside down. Absolutely upside down. For example, in the you've got a lot of information in your handout. William Wordsworth, English Romantic poet. The Romantic Revolution, if you wanted to give it a date, it would be 1798 with William Wordsworth publishing the lyrical ballads. Tintern Abbey is in there, and that piece specifically. Nature became his god. He said, William Wordsworth is the one who said, follow your heart, it will never lie. What's that a corruption of? The heart is deceitfully wicked. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We can look at romanticism and see absolute corruptions of biblical principles. Absolute corruptions. Let's say the green concept. Now, for 17 years, the defining pattern had been theological. For 1,700 years after Christ, everything was theological. We just believed it. And now, 1798, everything is going to change. Everything's going to change. The green concept. Now, we're progressing, and this is still remains today. We see romanticism, which is going to lead to realism, which is going to get worse and get into naturalism, which is going to become modernism, complete rejection of anything traditional, and into postmodern. That's the progression that we're going to see. And all of those are under the heading and within romanticism. Romanticism remains and prevails today. The green concept. We see that today with companies. How green are they? How green are you? If you have a revolution of the hierarchy conception, what is now at the top?
Earth.
Okay. Right, Earth first. That's right. Reduce the human imprint. Okay, you get it. Hug a tree. The English gardens. What do English gardens look like now? They used to be perfect and gorgeous. What's the English garden look now? Wild, untamed. Wild, untamed. Yeah. Wildflowers are flowers now instead of weeds. Okay? Worshipping the creation instead of the creator. Okay, Adam was put to be, he was put to have dominion over the earth. He was put in charge of the earth. Yes, he is supposed to be a good steward of the earth. And you put that upside down, and what do you see? We're supposed to serve the earth, take care of her needs. Absolute revolution of a biblical principle. Look at when Romans 1:25 says, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. The noble savage. Okay? We, for all of literature until the Romantic Revolution, we had these incredible heroes. If you read Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, oh my goodness, the women in that book are the most virtuous, pure, incredible women. You know, when she's kidnapped and carried off to the castle and she's up in the room and the guy might embrace her, you know, nothing awful is going to happen in Sir Walter Scott, and he's going to embrace her or grab her or something, she stands in the window and she's going to jump rather than have him touch her. And it's just, and he, you know, even though he's the bad guy, he's a noble bad guy, and so even though he's the bad guy, he says, no, I'll make you love me, I'll just keep you here until you love me, I'll never profane you. And so we had these characters, even the evil guys were okay, you know, for being evil guys. And so we had these heroes you could imitate. That's all gone now with Romanticism. There are no more heroes. The heroes are gone. We have the noble savage, the anti-hero. That's what we have today, the anti-hero. The calm, ordered thinker type hero was replaced with a rebel, a noble savage. Noble savage. The savage is elevated above the civilized man. Think of Indiana Jones. Okay? The calm, orderly thinker guy is replaced. You have to have a rebel. He's got to be a rebel and follow the beat of his own drum. He's got to be different. He's got to be different. Perry Mason is out, and MacGyver is in. Now, I've never seen MacGyver, but I've heard my students talk about him. Apparently, he's some detective who always somehow finds what he needs to save himself or the world or something at the last moment. But he doesn't follow the rules. He's a rebel. That's our hero now. Perry Mason's out. The calm, orderly thinker is out. And that's the standard, that's your standard Disney hero. That's why when you see some of the Disney movies and they rub you the wrong way, that's why. It's offending your Christian sensibilities because it's trivializing something you hold to be sacred, which is heroes to be imitated. And this bothers you. What's the biblical principle for that? The noble savage, I'm not sure where it's at. If you diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. 1 Samuel 15:23, "For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you rejected the word of the Lord, he's rejected you from being king." That's Nathan, the prophet Nathan, telling that to Samuel, the king. The biblical principle is calm, orderly, a pattern, obey, obey, obey. And what we have today in our anti-heroes is do your own thing, the rebel hero. Innocence replaces wisdom. Hippies, the flower children, never trust anybody over 30. Weird society is to blame. Freud wrote Civilization and Its Discontents. That's only a few pages long. You can read it, telling how civilization has ruined mankind, specifically Christianity has ruined mankind because we've given him the conscience and made him feel guilty about things. And if only he could raise up a child not knowing all of those things, they'd be free from all of that. No more. And what do we have? What's the biblical principle? The city fathers who sit in the gates. You know, you don't have, they earned the respect of the community. We didn't have career politicians in the Bible, you know, in their 20s, on their third marriages. You didn't have, you know, the guys that sat in the gates in the Bible were the guys with one wife whose children had proven that they could handle this job. 2 Chronicles 10:8, "But he forsook the counsel of the elders which they had given him and consulted with the young men who grew up with him and served him." You remember that. And so absolute corruption of a biblical principle. Sensibility, following your heart. I may be out of order for these concepts. Sensibility, following your heart. Children are seen as hapless victims of poverty and exploitation. Now we see occult fantasies. We didn't have characters like this before. Dracula and Frankenstein, things that could not be in God's natural world. We didn't have those before. Now we have these characters. That's what we have today, the horror movies. You've got lots of authors here. The important ones to read would be William Blake. You're going to get some wonderful Christian stuff there. Beautiful poem about Jerusalem. And he's the one who did illustrations just for everything. Illustrations, lots of illustrations. William Wordsworth, Tintern Abbey and the Lyrical Ballads is critical for you to read. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, his friend, the Kubla Khan, which is highly, highly overrated, which he wrote while under the influence of opium. In fact, he didn't finish it because someone interrupted him. These are the major English poets. Well, it's important to know things like that. Read some information on William Wordsworth. If you're doing American romanticism, you'd be reading Thoreau and thinking how wonderful when he wrote Walden, but you need to know that, you know, he wrote Walden during the week, and on the weekends he went in town and got drunk and caroused. And so, the picture they paint is not the picture that they lived. Victorian, I think you probably know a little bit about Victorian life. Everything looks really clean, but lots of dirty living. their lifestyle is failing them. And so what we see in literature, we see romantic triangles, things like that. Things that you didn't see in literature before. We're really getting wild now. Novels become popular, mass-producing novels. Culture and religion, literature is reaching the masses, it's cheap, and so you can publish magazines, you can have serial stories, you know, a little bit each month come out. These are the authors: Dickens, Hardy, Kipling, Stevenson, Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray. That's, you know, kind of a ugly one, but you probably should read it as a parent. Darwin, the beginning of social Darwinism. Well, we talked about this during the last hour. If you believe that black people are only two-thirds human, that they're still part animal because they have not evolved as quickly as we have, it's really easy to justify keeping them as slaves, isn't it, or treating them differently. And then, of course, Darwin's views on women were also very low. And so we have a social Darwinism that has now crept in to the culture, and this is part of Romanticism also. Modernism and all it has taken away from Western civilization is the prime example of depravity and moral decline from attempts to remove the Bible from our culture. All moral progress, this might be Ruth B. Chick, I can't remember who said this, this is not me. All moral progress of Adam's race comes directly from the Bible. It is the dividing line between chaos and real civilization. To ignore the great Western thinkers who have shaped our culture is foolish. The only reason we can possibly give for the impact these men made is that they gave men an excuse to be what they truly wanted to be. They glorified rebellious men as intellectuals, introducing elaborate arguments to explain away simple truths, pandering to the lusts of unregenerate men with promises of clear consciences and relative morality. And did it work? No, do we have? No. That was me. That one sentence was the person I can't remember, so if you want to blame anybody else for that, that's me. All the things that we see in the literature, we are getting into postmodernism. Where's my postmodernism? Oh, modernism, postmodernism. I'm there. Okay. What we see, modern means anti-tradition. The modernists, you know, we went through wars. England went through wars. Every time you go through a war, it gets more depressing, and the literature that gets written right after that is pretty depressing and gets a little sarcastic and hopeless, kind of pathetic. And so what you see in modern and postmodern writing is this awful search for peace, never finding the hero. We don't have resolution at the end of the book. You don't like the way the movie ends. You don't like the way the book ends. We saw a movie a couple of years ago called The Perfect Storm, and I can't believe now I watched that movie. All these guys dying and going to hell, and I was so disappointed because I was waiting to see who's going to survive, which one's going to make it and go home and fix their life. And when we finished watching it, my husband said, "Well, didn't you know that's how it ended?" Because he had heard that at work, and no, I didn't know that. That's modernism, postmodernism in a nutshell. No resolution, no satisfaction to the reader or the viewer, no hero. All of those guys led pathetic lives and went to hell. It was also a novel. That's what we're going to see. What's coming up next after postmodernism? I don't know what they're going to label where we're at now. What we're seeing now is a very sad mix of everything. Mostly romanticism. You know, we can call it realism. We can call it naturalism. I have one poem. This is from this lady. She's the Plasmatics. I don't know if you can see she's shaved her head except for this tuft on the top. Okay. Who staged theatrics as lead singer of the punk band The Plasmatics, included blowing up equipment and chainsawing guitars, has committed suicide. She was 48. These are some of the... Now, these are words by another group. This is called Offspring. I believe that reality's gone, disillusion's real. I believe that morality's gone, and there's nothing to feel. If you take the sacred things, the things that we hold dear, empty promise is all you'll find. So give me something, something to believe in. I believe in a changing of the guard. Put our feet on the ground. See it happen in your own background. Everything breaks down. Do you accept what you are told without even thinking? Throw it on, make your own, and give me something, something to believe in. Where they lead, you will follow. Well, I guess that's just the way it goes. And if you look away, you'll be doing what they say. And if you look alive, you'll be singled out and tried. And if you take home anything, let it be your will to think. The more cynical you become, the better off you'll be. These are lyrics. I got these. They're lyrics by Offspring, and I would guess if we heard the music, we probably wouldn't be able to know what the lyrics were. I've never heard the music, but the lyrics are very revealing and telling, and that's where we're at today. So what we have to do is, knowing what we know, prepared with how we're prepared, we don't want to just read books to read books. We want to read these books to show our kids this is the progression that man has made through English literature, and this is where we're at today, and it's time for some change. So, you know, raise up those writers. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, did I give you the website address? It's at the bottom of the handouts for the purpose of the tape. It's www.thelmaslibrary.com. And there are also, did I tell you there are downloadable how to do the character study, theme study? I told you all of that. Okay, so you have all that. Thank you very much. The Lord bless you.